Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast app, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
This is episode number 26 in our series for 2019, and today's date is Friday, July the 26th. First, I talked to Philip Morris, Australia Managing Director Tammy Chan, looking at how the company has closed the pay gap between male and female employees and embraced gender equality. It's a model for other businesses. And then I'll talk to Indeed economist Callum Pickering, looking at Australia's latest job market figures. They're not good, and he says they'll get worse. But first, let's talk to Tammy Chan. Well, Tammy Chan, congratulations on achieving equal salary certification.
Thank you so much.
How did you do it?
How did we do it? I think I would start off by saying we obviously didn't do everything we're trying or will continue to do for this award. And it started already quite some time ago. For quite obvious reason. I mean, because of the nature of the industry, we are in tobacco, and that's why, I mean, has always been very male-dominated, and therefore we became aware of the issues that if we don't do anything on a sustainable basis to attract and retain, particularly women, we will have a big problem. And I think this kind of, you know, foresightedness to become aware of the issue early on help us a lot by putting a lot of small acts together. Everything has to be relevant to our employee. It's not one size fit all. And all these years, our learning experience have got us here.
So, I mean, what proportion of your workforce is female?
We have 44% of the female and across the organisation, which is, I think, quite balanced. And that surprised many people as well. You know, tobacco company, we have almost half of the people working for us as women.
Well, that's quite extraordinary. Now, but how did you go about addressing this gender pay issue? I mean, what steps did you actually take?
I think fundamental number one is look at the details. And we have actually very well established systems. Say, for example, when we arrange pay increase, I don't even get to see the gender of the individual I'm looking at. It's all about their performance. I didn't even pay attention to their last name. Really, it doesn't matter where they come from. Just look at their performance and then history and the potential, and that's how we determine the pay. Same for our hiring. So, in fact, I mean, if we offer the position, same grade, same job, we pay the same. So we never question or even post in the ad whatever they said, male or female. In fact, on the contrary, we are paying more attention to make sure we are hiring 50-50, you know, for the new position. Do we actually interview enough female to make sure that we don't actually discriminate one way or the other?
Do you actually go and seek out female, likely female candidates?
First of all, we all our ad or whatnot is gender neutral. However, we actually, as a manager, particularly in certain function where we are underrepresented by male women, we will look at, you know, have we actually looked at all the available CV, all the available candidates to see whether we have sourced enough women for interview. The rest is still strictly meritocracy, but we do want to make sure we allow enough opportunity for the potential women candidates to have the interview.
Now, which areas are women better equipped at the job than men?
I don't know. I wouldn't say actually that there is a particular function, but in our case, we have certain functions that are more represented by women. Say, for example, people in culture, we have more women than the average. And in the case of, say, for example, external affairs, we have a little bit more men than women. So that's why individual function, individual hiring is important rather than to look at the average number.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, when you started, was there a big pay gap? I mean, it's about 14%. It's the usual statistics for the pay gap between male and female. Was it about that level?
Well, to be honest, I don't know the number because we started quite some early on, and back then we really didn't look at this on a statistical or on a systematic basis. And then what we've learned, I think a couple of years ago, when we really started to look at the number, our gap was never 14. I think that's the number in Australia. But I cannot quote a specific number as far as Philip Morris International is concerned. And I just joined here like a year and a half ago. But when I got here, actually the pay or the gap already is like what we are seeing today.
Right. So it was already closing,
yes.
as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So it was simply a case of just not looking at the gender of people you give pay rises to.
Yeah, this sounds easy, right?
But it sounds very easy.
Sounds very easy, but I guess when we talk about the core of the issues, it would take a lot of assumption, you know, between what men can do, what women can do, and as a result, what we should pay them. And by ignoring them, actually just look at the performance of that individual regardless of gender. I think that's the key.
Well, it's quite extraordinary. If it's so easy, why aren't other companies doing this?
I think, as I said, maybe there are certain biases or there are certain assumptions that may have to get challenged. Is that really by, you know, looking at the gender, we can actually quantify certain difference, right? But of course, I cannot speak on behalf of the other companies, but what I do want to say is really warrant attention of the management, and I think the more company can do that and challenge a lot of this maybe bias or unbiased assumption, I think we'll go a long way.
Now, you are on the way to achieving 40% female management. I think you're at 35% now.
At the international level.
That's quite extraordinary.
Yes, indeed. And yeah, actually 35 is not so bad, but we wanted to set the band higher as well. We are encountering some challenge, therefore more concerted effort is important, all the way from hiring. Pay is one thing, but also retention. How are we actually retaining the people, right, once we hire them? Pay is just one part. How can we motivate them to make sure that despite the different life stages, women will stay with us, but the same token men as well as they go through different life challenges.
So retention is a big issue on this.
Yes. And I think retention is actually a very, very important part that require more attention. Because retention that works for a certain group of women or men actually may not work for the other group as well. So it's all these little details what matters the most. We always say flexibility just to say something, but flexibility actually means something very different between different groups, between mother, between someone who seeks education, but everyone's motivation is different. I think it's just by looking at the individual motivator and what works for them during that particular period of time is much better or much more effective than a general rule of thumb.
So you have to look at each and every of your talent employees.
Yes, and I think this we are doing quite well.
That takes a lot of effort and a lot of work, doesn't
it? Indeed, but it's part of the manager job as well. If we cannot retain the good people, I think it means that the results cannot be achieved as well. And what we learn is actually to hire good people will take even more efforts than to retain them. So I think it's a very good investment of manager's time to do so.
Right, okay, okay. So, I mean, how did you go about developing your people? Do you do courses? Do you do training? All of that? Do you offer that?
Yeah. And yes, we do. But actually, the way we are offering that is changing as well. We are a very global company, so what we have been actually doing well is basically courses and put people in challenging assignment in different countries as well. This we'll keep on doing, but I think in today's world, a lot more is online learning. Very recently, we actually offer all our employee online, actually remote MBA class offered by a university in the US as well, and everyone can sign up. And that really touch upon a lot of the competency that we require in terms of leadership. So we are using the more conventional way, moving people, and also the new way of delivering training, including online, including self-learning as well. So we are making improvement. And I think the most important thing is for employee to understand that if they wanted to learn, it's the growth mindset, there is always a way, and you have to find time in order to progress as well.
Indeed, indeed. And did you have to do an audit or anything of that, of what you required?
On the training?
On the training?
Yeah, we have actually a lot of survey. And when we design the program, we also take the feedback, whether the way of delivery is good or it's actually achieved the objective. So, I mean, this feedback mechanism is working quite well in terms of getting the feedback, whether the training suits them. And of course, day-to-day work, we actually see the progress of the employee, whether they're applying it or not. Because when we send people on training, we actually make the manager aware of the training objective as well. And I think it's important for the manager to keep an eye on, you know, the applicability, on whether or not the individual is accepting or applying it.
Well, that would mean that you would constantly have to be monitoring the situation, wouldn't you, for all the employees to ensure that you do get to that 40% level?
Our objective would be all. I mean, but obviously we cannot do that sometimes. And however, we actually keep track of a bit the assessment on the potential of potential of the employee, and we just try to apply that accordingly as well. So say, for example, certain employees are doing a little bit more transactional, maybe that needs is a little bit less, but for the people that we see the potential, the effort will also be different.
And so what are the big challenges in doing that?
The challenges, I think I alluded to, is to look at individual. And I think when we come to human being, when we come to employee, we talk about different generation have different motivation. We talk about different gender have different motivation. And I think one thing that we have been actually keep on reminding ourselves is don't only look at the history. Look at what's the trend and really look at what matters and what the employee are telling us, rather than this is the training, go and take it and our job is done. So it's this individual attention to the development.
So you've heard it constantly and you've constantly got to be on top of that.
Yeah, and this is actually a very big part of my job.
Right. Well, Tammy Chan, it's been delightful talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your time.
And now let's talk to Indeed economist Callum Pickering. Callum Pickering, the latest unemployment figures of 5.2%. No one was expecting it to be that bad. It means Australia's unemployment rate is still stuck at that rate. What's your assessment of it?
Yeah, overall, the jobs report was a little bit of a mixed bag. Overall, probably a little bit on the negative side. There were a few positives in there as well. With the unemployment rate of 5.2%, that's obviously quite high compared with where it was 6 months ago when it actually dipped below 5%. It's heading in the wrong direction, and certainly it appears as though it may even increase a little bit further over the remainder of the year. One of the really weak numbers was the employment figures, just 500 jobs created in the month. I guess it could have been worse, could have been negative, but 500 jobs is certainly much weaker than we've seen over the past couple of years. Now, I think we do need to put that number into a little bit of context, March through to May was quite strong for employment growth. There was about 107,000 jobs created over those 3 months. So if you look at it as sort of a four-month block, it doesn't look that bad. But in isolation, it's obviously not a great number. In terms of one of the more positive things, though, was that the participation rate increased to 66%, which is a new record high. So the Australian economy is becoming a little bit more inclusive. More people are entering the workforce and getting involved, and that's always a good thing.
However, the fundamental issue is the number of job seekers versus the number of vacancies, and there are more job seekers than vacancies at the moment.
That's absolutely right. One of the issues we do have right now is that there is 2.9 unemployed people per job vacancy. And if you include the underemployed, that jumps up to 7.6. Now, that maths isn't great if you're a job seeker and you're looking to, certainly if you're looking to enter the workforce. So it does indicate that it's a real struggle for those out there who don't have jobs or don't have the type of jobs they want, because there just isn't enough opportunities out there.
Which would indicate that job seekers are taking longer to find work.
It can do, absolutely. And it means that if you do find yourself unemployed, then it can be a real struggle to get back in the labour market as well.
All of this coincides, of course, with the debate over Newstart, which hasn't been increased for 25 years. And the figures show that the greatest demographic group on Newstart are the over 55s who have been forced out of work and are unlikely to find work anytime soon.
Yeah, that's right. When we think of Newstart, we often think about young people, and there are certainly a lot of young people on Newstart. But it is that over 55 group that find themselves on Newstart and really face an uphill challenge to get back in the labour market. Whenever you look at labour mobility statistics, it's much easier for young people to get back in the job market than it is for older people. So if you are over the age of 55 and you do find yourself unemployed, that could, in some cases, be the last job you have. And so you're on Newstart until you sort of enter that retirement phase and you have access to your superannuation and the pension and things of that nature. So it can be a real challenge because...
Yeah, well, there's been various calls. There's calls from Labor, calls from the Greens. I think the Greens are introducing legislation this week to increase Newstart. There's calls from business. Even Barnaby Joyce and John Howard have come out in favour of increasing Newstart. But the government seems to be committed to maintaining its surplus.
Yeah, that's right. They're putting the surplus ahead of, I guess, the financial needs of well over a million Australians. The Newstart allowance simply isn't sufficient to keep its recipients out of poverty today. If you look back over its history, 20 years ago it was about 45% of the median income. Today it's about 31%. So it's falling behind. It continues to fall behind year after year because it's only indexed to the CPI. And wages tend to increase by more than the CPI per year. So it's becoming an increasingly poor way of keeping its recipients out of poverty and keeping their heads above water.
This is very interesting because the seniors seem to have become quite a powerful lobbying force, having secured changes to the deeming rates, for whatever that might be worth. Do you expect they'll be lobbying the government on this?
I hope so. I think, you know, in my mind, it's quite clear that the Newstart allowance needs to be higher than it currently is. We need a better safety net in this country for those who are most vulnerable. And the baby boomers and the Gen Xers, they are a powerful lobbying group. They do seem to be able to get things done when they push government. So I do hope that we do see a lot of these over 55s pushing for a higher Newstart allowance, because that really needs to get some traction across politics.
And it's said that if you increase a Newstart allowance, it would actually boost the economy because there'd be more spending.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Newstart recipients tend to spend every cent they get because they don't have much to begin with. So if you increase the Newstart allowance by $75 per person, then almost all of that's going to be recycled back into the economy, whether it be through restaurants or retail or you know, any area of the economy. So it would directly boost the economy.
Right, okay. Now, The RBA would be keeping a very sharp eye on these unemployment figures. Where do you think this is going to leave the RBA?
Well, I don't think they'd necessarily be surprised by this outcome. So the unemployment rate staying at 5.2%, that's pretty much what they would expect. I think they might decide not to focus too much on only 500 jobs being created, because there was that strength in the three previous months. So I don't think it necessarily changes anything from their economic outlook. I do, however, believe that they are likely to cut rates again before the end of the year. I think November is probably the most likely month, because it does coincide with an update to their economic forecasts. Certainly the market expects that to be the case, and they're also pricing in a 50% chance of a second rate cut next year as well.
So that would take the rates down to 0.75% if there's another rate cut next year?
Absolutely. And certainly if the market has their way, might even get down to 0.5%.
That is quite alarming.
Absolutely. I mean, who would have thought a couple of years ago that we'd be in this situation? And certainly with inflation so low and there being a range of economic issues that we are facing, it does appear likely that rates will remain sort of at this level for probably another couple of years at the very least.
This unemployment figure suggests that wages growth will remain stuck at about 2%, 2.3% for some time.
Yeah, I mean, basically every forecast that was assuming that wage growth would increase was doing so on the back that the unemployment rate was declining, that unemployment rate was going down, that the underutilisation rate was going down as well. That's now no longer the case. The unemployment rate's pushed up over the past 6 months. The underutilisation rate remains elevated. Neither of those point towards improving wage growth. So we're at 2.3% right now. It's quite possible over the next 6 to 12 months that wage growth could actually get a little bit weaker, pushed down to a 2.2 or a 2.1%. So we're certainly not heading in the right direction there.
You would need an unemployment figure to have a 4 or a 3 in front of us, surely, for there to be an impact on wages.
Well, that's certainly the global experience. The US struggled to generate much wage inflation until they got down to around 4%. Same was true of the United Kingdom. So, and I mean, we got down to just below 5%. We could barely generate much improvement in wages at all. So you would think that something close to a 4 would be needed for wage growth to push towards that 3% level.
Right, but and the other worrying part, of course, as we've discussed before, is the growth markets are Melbourne and Sydney.
Yeah, one of the concerns I've had for some time now has been how concentrated employment growth has been in Australia. So it is primarily Sydney and Melbourne. They have a much stronger labour market compared with the rest of the country. The unemployment rate in Sydney and Melbourne is down sort of around 4.5%. You compare that to around 6 or even a little bit above for the rest of Australia. So we do have a bit of a two-speed labour market right now, and I think that if conditions were to soften in Sydney and Melbourne, then it would be difficult for the other states to fill that gap.
So if conditions were to soften here because of the property market, that would have an impact?
Absolutely. I think that the property market is one potential area where Sydney and Melbourne could certainly soften. But it's just sort of the broader point. It can be any sort of trigger, but if Sydney and Melbourne soften, then the other states are just not in a great position to sort of absorb those losses.
Well, that's quite alarming, and we'll be watching the next set of figures. What do you forecast for the next set of figures?
Well, I think the labour market's probably likely to soften a little bit in the near term. I expect the unemployment rate to tick up towards 5.3, maybe even 5.4 by the end of the year.
Well, we'll be watching that with fascination. Callum Pickering, thank you very much for your time.
And thanks for having me.
So what's happening in the news? Well, the global economy is in a precarious position and likely to slow, the International Monetary Fund has warned. Releasing its mid-year update to its World Economic Outlook, the IMF downgraded forecast growth for this year and next by 0.1 percentage points. At 3.2%, world gross domestic product growth is tipped to be its slowest since 2009, during the depths of a global financial crisis. And Amazon is hoping to build up its channel streaming business for launch in Australia in 2020. Amazon has been meeting with local content providers and broadcasters to scope out their interest for putting their content on Amazon channels. Amazon Channels is an additional product available on top of subscription video on demand service Amazon Prime Video, which launched in Australia in 2016. It acts as a hub or aggregator for third-party channels and streaming services in a similar vein to Foxtel and Fetch, except it does not involve hardware such as a set-top box. In the US, Amazon has more than 100 channels, ranging from HBO, Showtime, CBS All Access, Major League Baseball, NBA League Pass, Comedy Central, and Stars. The US viewing landscape is highly fragmented. For content providers, Amazon Channels is another avenue to market to tap into people who don't subscribe to traditional cable TV. For consumers who don't have cable or pay TV, Amazon Channels essentially acts as a new format of pay TV providers, but online only, and allows them to pick and choose their content. In the US, Amazon makes channels available to its Prime subscription customers for a fee. For example, the HBO channel is US$14.99 per month, and Showtime is US$8.99 per month, and gives those third-party providers an avenue to market leveraging Amazon's scale. However, in Australia, HBO and Showtime do not have direct-to-consumer streaming services like they do in America, and they've signed exclusive deals with Foxtel and Stan, which is owned by Nine, publishers of the Financial Review, The Age and Sydney Morning Herald. The deals also cover a life of series, meaning Amazon would not have access to popular shows that began during the current deals as long as they continue to be made. And this coincides with the former chief executive of Foxtel warning the pay TV business will need to have a dramatic overhaul to stay competitive and shore up its earnings as Australians turn towards Netflix. Peter Tonagh, who was Foxtel's CEO for about 2 years until January 2018, when he was replaced by Patrick Delaney, says that the embattled business would not be able to spend as much on content, including sports, in future. Foxtel is set to make a swathe of changes next week, which is expected to include a rumoured partnership with Netflix and software updates to the iQ3 and iQ4 set-top television boxes. And the federal government has accused Labor of being trapped in a welfare mentality over its calls to increase Newstart, a move Treasury has forecast will cost $12.4 billion over the four-year forward estimates and $39 billion over a decade. Facing growing calls to boost the unemployment payment by as much as $75 a week, the government has gone on the offensive, accusing Labor of putting welfare before aspiration. On Newstart, Labor has not nominated a dollar increase, just that it should be boosted following a review. The Greens and the welfare lobby are among those calling for $75 a week. Others demanding an increase in Newstart, which had its last above inflation boost in 1994, include the Business Council of Australia, KPMG, the ACTU, Coalition backbencher Barnaby Joyce, and National Seniors Australia. The seniors group has become engaged as a consequence of growing unemployment among older people of working age, some of whom, especially women, are destitute. There are 173,196 people aged over 55 on Newstart. The government is ideologically opposed to a real increase in Newstart, and it argues that most recipients of the payment, currently $277 a week, are on other welfare payments as well. It argues Newstart is designed to help find work and is not meant to be a living allowance, like the age pension. And it is also guarding its promise to return the budget to surplus in 2019-20. And low interest rates won't be enough for Australia to generate wage growth, the Reserve Bank and Morrison government have been warned, amid signs shoppers are continuing to tighten their belt. As Labor calls on the government to do more for those parts of Australia where the jobless rate is above 20%, exclusive analysis by Burnson Young suggests a key part of the RBA's plan to lift wages may fail without a major change in government policy. The bank has cut official interest rates twice since the start of June, with the stated aim of driving the unemployment rate down to at least 4.5%, which it believes will be low enough to put upward pressure on wages. But Ernst & Young chief economist Joe Masters said there were now 462,000 more Australians looking for work than job vacancies, while underemployment, those people wanting more working hours, is 8.2%. Ms. Masters pointed to the US, where the unemployment rate was at a 50-year low, and there were 1 million more vacancies and people out of work, and yet wage growth was only now starting to lift. In New South Wales, there were 115,000 more people looking for work than available vacancies. In Victoria, 98,000. And in Queensland, 128,000. And top financial executives may soon have to wait 7 years to claim all their bonuses as the banking, insurance and superannuation regulator moves to align pay with long-term performance. APRA is proposing to cap the financial performance component of executive incentives to 50%. The proposals would allow boards to claw back remuneration for up to 4 years after it was issued if problems later arose. The executive pay guidelines follow scathing findings from the Banking and Financial Services Royal Commission. Responding to a key recommendation from the Financial Services Royal Commission, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority concluded that existing remuneration practices were not incentivising the right behaviours in financial companies. The far-reaching proposals would see lucrative bonuses for top executives deferred for as long as 7 years and give company boards the power to claw back incentives for up to 4 years after they were paid out in cases where poor performance or misconduct became apparent. The overhaul of executive pay would cover all APRA-related entities, including the Big Four banks and AMP, which were heavily criticised in Kenneth Hayne's Royal Commission findings earlier this year, with a focus on senior executives at complex institutions. APRA Deputy Chair John Lonsdale said the Commission's findings played a key role in prompting the changes. And Carlton United Breweries, the maker of seminal Australian brands like Victoria Bitter, Carlton Draft, Great Northern and Crown Lager, has been acquired by Japan's Asahi for $16 billion. With local beer sales slumping in recent years, the blockbuster takeover may help facilitate a revival of sales locally, industry advocates say. CUB's previous owner was a Brazilian beer behemoth, Anheuser-Busch InBev. The deal will trigger review from Australia's competition watchdog, beginning with an assessment of Asahi's new combined market share. And the Foreign Investment Review Board will also take a close look at Japanese brewer Asahi's financing and tax mitigation practices in Australia before it approves the $16 billion acquisition of Carlton United Breweries. Judging by the capital structure of Asahi's Australian business, which makes Schweppes and Pepsi soft drinks, Spring Valley juices, Coleridge bottled water, and Mountain Goat beer, the Japanese brewer is likely to look at tax-effective ways to maximise returns from its latest acquisition. According to Asahi Australia's accounts, the company earned $101.5 million before interest and tax on revenues of $1.8 billion in the year to December 30, 2018, but paid $84.8 million in finance costs, reducing its pre-tax profit to just $18.4 million. And at least $80 million of the finance costs was interest or dividends on $816.6 million in redeemable preference shares, which were issued on December 29th. To repay an $816.6 million interest-free related party loan from Asahi Group. And the chief executive of the world's largest mining company has endorsed drastic action to combat global warming, which he calls indisputable and an emerging crisis. The planet will survive, many species may not, BHP chief executive officer Andrew McKenzie told a business breakfast in London on Tuesday. This is a confronting conclusion, but as a veteran geologist once said, you can't argue with a rock. McKenzie endorsed carbon pricing but said it was not enough to combat the looming threat of mass extinctions and major sea rises. He announced BHP was spending US $400 million, that's 570 million Australian, to create a climate investment program to reduce emissions from its own operations as well as those generated from its resources. And a judge has given Clive Palmer a dressing down for his absence during the Queensland nickel trial, saying other people who represented themselves in court could not afford to hire lawyers and still showed up every day. Despite Mr. Palmer's personal wealth valued at $4 billion, Mr. Palmer has chosen to represent himself in the trial, which is looking at the months leading up to the downfall of the Townsville refinery, which went into administration in January 2016. Clive Palmer has been missing in action during some days of trial. Mr. Palmer sat at the bar table in the court for the first 2 days of the trial last week, but was then nowhere to be found after that. Mr. Palmer says his work as a company director had stopped him from making it to court. Justice Mullins said usually company directors hired lawyers so they don't waste time. Liquidators are trying to claw back $200 million from Mr. Palmer and his associates. The billionaire, who once listed litigation as his hobby in his Who's Who entry, has missed almost 2 days of a Supreme Court trial in Brisbane while acting as his own barrister against a liquidator's bid to claw back $200 million from him and his associates. Mr. Palmer told the court on Monday he was torn between being a self-represented litigant and a busy company director. Justice Deborah Mulland shot back that most people in his position hire lawyers so they don't waste time in court. The businessman also told the court on Monday morning he planned to lodge an application to challenge the claim by a lawyer for liquidators Graham Gibson last week that Mr. Palmer's mining tenements in the Galilee Basin were worthless. He released a statement on Friday describing liquidators as bloodsuckers and leeches in their liquidation of Queensland Nickel. And profit margins at Australian restaurants have nosedived since the arrival of delivery apps like Uber Eats and Deliveroo, with apps scooping up about 30% of food order totals just in commission. Margins have plunged from about 10% to between 2 and 4%, according to the Restaurant and Catering Industry Association. The group also claims Australia's urban and restaurant culture has inexorably shifted. More consumers are beginning to abandon eating in, forcing establishments to strip out seating and sack waitstaff to survive. An online retailer, Kogan.com, returned to earnings growth in the June half, but growth in new customers, sales and commissions is slowing amid increased competition from Amazon, eBay, Catch Group and omni-channel retailers. Chief Executive Ruslan Kogan said that earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortisation had risen more than 25% in the 6 months ended June 30 after falling 5.7% in the previous half year and more than doubling in 2018. Gross transaction values, which include sales and commissions from verticals such as Kogan Mobile, Kogan Internet, Kogan Insurance and the new Kogan Marketplace, rose more than 9% in the June half. This compared with GTV growth of 12.9% in the December half and 47.3% growth in 2018. Growth in new customers has also slowed, with active customers rising 4.3% to 1.609 million in the June half and by just 1.3% in the June quarter, well below the 32.2% active customer growth in the first half of 2019 and 45.3% in 2018. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Jonathan Miller, Managing Director of BitTrade and BitTrade Labs. BitTrade is a digital platform for the everyday Australians to trade and manage their blockchain assets, including Bitcoin and Ether. BitTrade Labs, on the other hand, is an incubator for blockchain and distributed ledger projects. It is a mission of both companies to empower people with the tools and knowledge to trade blockchain assets. As a founding member of industry body Australian Digital Commerce Association, they are committed to the growth and mass adoption of blockchain and cryptocurrencies in Australia. And I'll be talking to CommSec economist Craig James about what's ahead in the market for the week. And of course, I'll be bringing you all the week's news. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at TalkingGiz, B-O-Z-Z, on Facebook and on LinkedIn. And if you want, leave a comment. Have a great week. Take care. Be good. Looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.